Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Read Lance Rosenthal with us, the author of Threads West, An American Saga, Book 1, Maps of Fate, Book 2, in the American Saga series. He's in. He's got the. Is the winner of 7 national awards. Is the number one best-selling debut novel. And again, from author Rancher Reed Lance Rosenthal, the first book of an 8-novel series that reminds us of the American spirit through a tale of romance, adventure, and Western history. Reed, I welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be on, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about an American saga, you know, we need books like you've got, because for some reason, Reed, we seem to be forgetting who we are. And the Tales of the West really puts it together, because that's really where we started. It was that kind of a world, and that's, where we came from. And for some reason, in the schools and everything else, it's starting to get diluted, and we're losing that.
You know, that's exactly right, Michael. I write because I want to write, but this is a story which has been bouncing around in my head for 30 years, and I have to tell you that, you know, it's about romance. It's about the universal energies of romance and the land and the West and the American spirit. And there's a message in this book, and the message in this book is a return to frontier values, you know. There's traits, I think, that can restore America. It's our touchstone, and I think if we're going to be moving forward in the type of America that we've come to know and to love, then I think we have to reach back for that touchstone of courage and self-reliance, and that's what this book is about.
Sure, and when you go back to it, we go all the way back, we take a look at, you know, mom and dad. You know, dad would teach the son to ride and shoot and hunt, and mom would teach the girls to cook and so on and so forth. Well, and then we had the little schoolhouse, maybe 8-10 kids in it, whatever. And then the railroad got invented, and then they went farther out, and then they got even farther out, and then mom and dad and that kind of a life lost it, because in those days, mom and dad were the be-all, end-all. They were the teachers. Now, mom and dad don't teach you how to drive. You have to go to driving school, you know, and the government tells you what to do and where to go. So there was somewhere along the way that we totally and completely got lost. And in that being lost, a dilution of what an American is happened also.
I happen to agree 100%. The series starts in 1855. It's the uncommon threads of disparate lives that come from different social origins, in fact, originate in Europe, and how they kind of wind together into the tapestry of an emerging nation. But the last book, the 8th book, when she's written, boy, it's a hell, it's a project, I will tell you. But I love it. The 8th book is in the real time of the contemporary West. So this is really, it's our story, you know. It is the story of us. And everything you say is true, and I'm just starting book 3, and book 2 is ready to be released here in the next 60 plus or minus days. And, you know, as I get more and more into the history of it, I can kind of see how we've lost our way, how we've kind of made things easy for ourselves, we thought, by shoveling off responsibilities to others. You know, the responsibilities, as you mentioned, of educating our kids, we've shoveled off to the school. And the school is run by the government. And the government is, shall we say, it's not our friend. You know, the government is there to take our rights, and we've allowed this to happen over time. It's one of the reasons, I think, that we need to go back to what made us great 234 years ago and to the crucible of where the American spirit was really forged, which I think is the West, the United States, and the great Western migration of the 1850s and 1860s.
Sure. When you talk about government not being our friend, we moved away from Western Europe. And what's going on right now is we're becoming what Europe is today. The transition is very interesting to see what's occurring. And if somebody doesn't wake up pretty soon, who we are and who we've been is not going to be here within the next, I think, 15 or 20 years. So realistically, we've got to have those markers, those little bit of those indicators that say, don't forget who you are. Don't forget how you navigate through life has to do with what you were taught an American is. And they're not teaching that anymore, because I sometimes read, I take a look at what's going on in the schools and get absolutely shocked to see what's being taught.
Oh, it's appalling. You know, my kids went to school in a very small school, 87 kids in the high school. And because it's so small, you knew the teachers, you knew what was being taught. But, you know, even there, the overburdening hand of government and federal mandates was apparent, although thankfully mostly ignored. And I will tell you that when you sit back and look at Europe, to go with that point of yours, which is excellent, you know, Europe is a disaster, and it's probably going to dissolve, and it's going to have, I think, material adverse effects on America. However, there is a silver lining to that cloud, because we have a very clear picture of where we will be if we don't mend our ways and get back to the past. It's kind of, you know, a back to the future, back to the past type of syndrome.
Yeah, but we have to really take a look at it, and I think that's where the concern is right now. There's so much, and I don't want to get off subject here, but there's so much media that is going on that is getting people confused out there. It's just a myriad of what everybody's hearing. Five or six different ways a story is told. You never hear the truth about anything anymore. Prime example, and I don't want to get political, but a prime example of where the confusion is coming from. Mitt Romney, he was talking about he wanted to have his choice of insurance companies, his choice of businesses, and he wants to be able to say who he works for, and if he wants to fire somebody, fire somebody. He's talking about businesses. He's talking about capitalism. He's talking about the way this country was set up in the first place. You don't like doing business with somebody, don't do it. That's not what the government's saying, and look what they've done to it. So the real messages today have to be impactful, and they have to be repetitive and over and over and over again until somebody finally gets it.
Well, that's really true, and you have to be aware that, you know, your whatever sounds you make will be taken in bites that best suits whoever is relaying it on to whatever audience they choose. And you know, to take Mitt Romney's example, you know, to say I like to fire people, and to take that one sentence out of it was a two-paragraph statement having to do with insurance companies, as you said, you know, is outrageous. But, you know, I think you're dealing with ideologues, even though they're a small percentage of American society. We've been asleep at the switch. We've allowed them to kind of intrude upon our lives. And now they have a lot of power. And it's going to take some pain, and it's going to take some work to get this ship of state turned around. But I think it starts with the individual. I think it starts with self-reliance. I think it starts in being secure in your convictions and proud of your beliefs and standing up for them. And I think it starts in your community. It's neighbor to neighbor, community standing together. And, you know, that really is the West. That is the West when the Great Migration occurred in the 1800s. And it's a set of values that I think carried through all the way through World War II until they started to dissipate. And we allowed them to dissipate. It's really our fault.
No question about it. When it comes down to it, Reed, it's your fault. It's my fault. It's everybody who has a piece or a part of this country, because somebody didn't stand up. Somebody got to a point of saying, what are you going to give me? And if you give me enough, I'm on your side. And we caved in.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, listen, our tax dollars are buying their votes. I mean, it's the antithesis of self-reliance.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And that's not the way it went in the West. Now, obviously, we were in a situation way back in the 1800s whereby you had the Pony Express. If you mailed somebody something, they might not get it for a month or so, if they even got it. And you had a lot of quote-unquote uneducated people. But most of those people knew what they were about. They got up in the morning. They knew what they had to do to survive for the day. They went to sleep with their families, and they were living a decent life. It wasn't muddled in all of this confusion and fear of if they say something, somebody's going to come and get them.
And listen, also, Michael, you know, they had values, and they were willing to fight for them, and they were willing to live by them. You know, I think, unfortunately, that those values have been eroded, and in some cases cast aside by many. And those are the values we have to return to. Turning around America starts with each one of us individually.
Let me give you a simple value, okay? I was brought up basically as a teenager in the 50s. Now, my mom was 5 foot tall, and if she opened the mouth, I shut up, and so did my brothers and sister. But there was family value. The kids today, I can't imagine using a four-letter expletive to my mom. The back of my neck still gets the hair crinkles up if I think about it. But that's value. We have lost the family value. What the agrarian society had, the farmers, etc., they had value. They had family, and they depended upon each other. It doesn't work that way today. Family is not family as we knew it, as we grew up with it. And family was the very base, the source of what America is about.
Absolutely. Family is the key unit, which I think constitutes the community. And the individual is the key unit of the family. And that's our basic building block. You know, the good news in all this is I think this tempest, this vortex of bad stuff that we're caught up in right now, I think that has awakened a lot of people. And I think that if it had continued kind of at the drip, drip, drip rate of the last 30, 40, 50 years, we might have gotten so far in the hole we can't get out. But I'm convinced we can get out. And I'm convinced that this country can be stronger and better and greater than it's ever been. But it's all going to start with you and me and other individuals who are listening to the show.
And realistically, Reed, when you come down to it, it's true, because I can vote for anybody I want to vote for. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that my vote is going to mean anything when it comes to the president, because we have the electoral system. But in essence, the people who run this country, they are supposed to be a reflection of the will of the people. The minute that stops, which it has stopped, then we're working for whoever it is that we quote-unquote hired. Interesting paradox. So when it comes down to it, we have politicians for the most part. We don't have statesmen. And what we need are statesmen. We need people to get in there and fight for you and I. And that's really, realistically, what we're not looking at. And most people, they listen to the, what are you going to give me? I've said it, you know, early on, but that's really what it's about. If you give me what I want, then I will vote for you. Otherwise, I won't vote for you. And that's horrible.
Absolutely. And those people have forgotten, you know, a basic rule of economics. Socialism works until you run out of other people's money.
Absolutely.
That's the bottom line of that. The entire system in which we elect people, the way in which they quote unquote represent us, that needs to be turned back. You know, everybody's fond of calling ourselves a democracy. I mean, particularly the left loves to use the word democracy. We're not a democracy. We're a representative republic. We need to go back to those principles. And you know, we have this finicky document that they don't seem to like. It's called the Constitution. It's really a good piece of work. And you know, it's not 2,300 pages like a healthcare bill. It's only 3, and it's worked for 234 years. And it's all about the individual. It's all about self-reliance. It's all about determination of each to their own and everybody's equal opportunity, not equal opportunity to create.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what we have here. People can talk about prejudice and being held back, and they can talk about gender or ethnicity or whatever the case may be. But when you come right down to it, you got an African-American that's president of the United States. You couldn't. How can you say that nobody has a chance? You had Cain, who's not running for president anymore, but this is a guy who came from poverty. Came from a place where he shouldn't have gotten anything, but you can't stop this man. And he moved all the way up the ranks. What we have in this country still is freedom of opportunity. That's the real freedom we've always had, and that's the freedom that we should have. Freedoms are being taken away, you know, one step at a time, and there's no question about that. And I think when I backed up, and I almost said I quit, but I will never, is when Pelosi got up and said, just sign it, and you'll find out what's in it after it's done.
That was an incredible moment. But you know, it was an epiphanistic moment. Yeah. Because you really got, you got a glimpse, you got a second's glimpse into the mind of that, into the how the mind of that mindset works. And you know what? She really believed that statement.
Well,
that's the scariest part. This was not a slip of the tongue. She really believed it. Yeah. The political elite believe that they can dictate how this country goes, what happens to individuals financially, economically, in terms of their health care, et cetera. And it, once again, it's the antithesis to the values of the Old West. You know, if you want opportunity, if you want a hand, you look at the end of your arm. That's what made this country great.
I completely and totally agree. You couldn't get an argument out of me for that. Reed, we're running out of time. I could talk to you all night. Where can we find you? Where can we find the book? Where can we buy the book?
You betcha. Folks can go to www.mapsoffate.com, and lots of fun stuff on the book and the rest of the series, too, at www.threadswestanamericansagaseries.com, and that'll give you all the information about reserving the book. It'll be available when it comes out on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, your local bookstore, you name it, and I must admit some bias, but I think folks will like it.
Hey, Reed, by the way, you're always welcome here, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Michael, it was a true pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Bye now.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Anthony Szilard with us, the CEO of the Executive Leadership Institute and the president of the Center for Social Leadership. He is the author of The Connection. Anthony was once named Visionary of the Year and featured at the Presidential Summit for American Future and American Promise as the leadership coach. He helps the CEOs and senior executives of Fortune 100 companies, small businesses, and the world's largest nonprofits such as GE, Disney, Nokia, Bank, the Bank of America, IBM, CARE, Save the Children, and the list goes on. Tony, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Michael. It's good to be on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's use that word connection. Tony, I think connection in and of itself is probably the little gremlin that causes everything to have a problem, because when you're not connected, when you're disconnected, things just don't work.
Well, exactly. I think, you know, it's interesting. When I was putting together the connection, writing it, that word is what really, really stuck out, because I realized that it's really the heart connection that we make with people that becomes what our greatest motivator, and also what the greatest motivator for them to buy our products or services or to work with us in whatever capacity. It's really this this connectedness that comes between people, and it's also the connection we make with our deepest passion and life vision, and how we integrate that into what we do every day.
Yeah, and I think the key to that is this, and it's a critically important point here, is that because we know that doesn't mean necessarily that we have the steps to take to make the connection. I go back to relationships, I go back to money, whatever the case may be. Where in the schools do they teach, do they prepare students to be in a relationship, how to handle money and so on and so forth, and where do they teach them how to connect? Tony, they don't do it.
Well, exactly, and that's because, you know, if you look back in the history of our country, I mean, there's just been this sort of belief as the United States sort of broke away from the English monarchy. You know, I think there was a sense that, you know, we're creating a democracy here, and anything to do with emotion, we kind of let go of it. We really focused on, you know, rational self-interest, and let's be really reasoned, and let's just look at the issues, and we kind of lost track of the connectedness that was perhaps, you know, also a downside of, you know, of a kind of some, you know, whether you call it a monarchy or a dictatorship.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, we wanted to get away from that favoritism, cronyism, and so forth. And it's interesting, as you look at it through a leadership lens, it's this connectedness cast in a much more positive light in terms of building relationships. That's the key to everything. I'll tell you a quick story. I was at the Frankfurt Book Fair. You know, we were selling some foreign rights contracts for the Connection back in October, and I would sit down and talk with people, and you know, we'd have conversations for a few minutes before we got to the point, and then I'd take, you know, we'd talk about 10 minutes about the book, and my agent at the Simon & Schuster booth came up to me after, right at the end of the fair, and she said, "Tony, the one thing I don't think that you realize here is that each of these people you're meeting with, you know, they just have like a few minutes to talk with you. I mean, they're seeing hundreds of books, and you're taking up 10 or 15 minutes of their time. Like, is this how you really think we're going to sell the most books?" And I said to her, I said, "Well, the thing is, I'm not here to sell books. I'm here to build relationships." And you know, we've had a whole slew of foreign rights contracts since then. And I think a lot of where it came from is that just by asking someone, "Okay, so you know, you're with an Italian publisher. Which part of Italy are you from?" "Oh, really? Okay, I was actually in this area once, and I've got a friend from," you know, and sort of talking and chatting for a bit, and then getting to the point. By the time I started to speak about the connection, we'd already made that connection. And so I think, you know, for a lot of your listeners, whatever business or industry you're in, whatever you're doing, it's that connectedness that keeps people coming back, especially in a tough economy like we're in today.
Tony, it, let's add a word to that. It's connectedness, but there's recognition, familiarity to get you to that connectedness. And let me give you a prime example of connection in business. I've done consulting on and off for years and years now, and I remember I would go into a business and I would sit down with the CEO, CFO, who COO, who was ever in charge, and I'd take their subordinate, the person right under them, and I'd say, "Okay, write down that person's job." And they would write down that person's job. And then I would go to that person and I would say, "Write down what you think your job is." And they would write it down. And we'd compare the two. 9.5 times out of 10,
it was different. Huh?
Absolutely. And the point of contention was that the connection wasn't there. And because of the inability to communicate in such a way that it's understood on both sides.
Absolutely. You know, I do a similar exercise when I'm doing the coaching with, you know, Fortune 100 CEOs, senior leaders, you know, companies like Disney, Nokia, IBM. What I do is I get the whoever's in the supervisor role, and then the supervisee, just as you did, and I have them each draw a circle, and in separate rooms. And then what I ask each of them to do is, like, you know, divide up the person that's being supervised. Divide up the way they should ideally spend their time. You know, and so each of them would do that, and you get completely different results, and you'd see that's sort of the disconnect. And so that, you know, that connection, it's interesting because in that case, it's just, hey, you know, I'm actually going to leave like what I need to get done right in this moment, and ask you about yourself, ask you about what you're doing. And most of us are so used to just, you know, spouting out what we want and what we need that we tend to focus less on you know, the other person as a human being.
Sure.
And what it is that really drives them.
Oh, by the way, Tony, ask me what my favorite subject is. Go ahead.
Sorry, what was that?
Okay, ask me what my favorite subject is.
Oh, sure, okay. Well, Michael, what's your favorite subject?
Me.
What are you most interested in?
Me. That, you get,
Well, you're very unique, Michael. I've never heard someone that was so that where their favorite subject was themselves. I think that's something, you know, it's about every human being I've ever met. Yeah, we all love to talk about ourselves. I think it's part of the human condition.
But if you want to, not you in the general sense of the word, Tony, but if you want to connect with anything, with a person, with a business, with a sale, it's got to be about the person on the other side of that desk. And my contention is, and I've seen it for years, there's where the disconnect happens. If you are promoting something, that person on the other side of the desk, the other side of the phone, wherever, 1 million, one person, it doesn't matter, it's all the same thing. There's got to be a sense of familiarity in what it is that you're communicating. That person's got to recognize themselves within what you're saying. Once that happens, the connection is made because now it's about them. And it's not so much we're selfish, but unless I see it or hear a benefit in what you're saying, it's gonna go right over my head, mine, anybody's head. Human nature.
Well, exactly, Michael. And then I think what happens a lot is that we are so disconnected from ourselves that we have no clue how to build a connection with someone else. You know, I think the voice that we have with ourselves is always the same voice that we have with others. And there's a huge tendency I've observed for people to not take that inner detour, not take that time. I have a leadership principle that I teach at our conferences, and it's called schedule solitude. You know, and it's really about that if you want to be a leader on the outside, you know, you first have to be a leader on the inside. You first have to look at, and that's really what the connection is about, you know, what is your deeper life vision? What do you really want to be remembered for? What do you most want to accomplish? If you project yourself out toward the end of your life, looking at you back now, you know, sitting here talking with me, what that white-haired man, what is he saying about what you're doing now? Does he say, Michael, this is great. I love the way you're spending your time. Or does he say, what the hell are you doing, Michael? Why aren't you doing X, Y, or Z? You know, and I think it's that sort of deeper, you know, that sort of a deeper vision emanating from our higher self. When we can connect with that and really build our relationship with ourselves, then we're really ready to build healthy relationships with others.
See, but Tony, that's why guys like you are out there. I'm saying this, you know, respectfully. We're not taught these things, and it's not innate, and it doesn't come naturally. You need somebody like yourself to look over somebody's shoulder through a different set of eyes, a different prism, and see what they don't see. If I see things in a certain way based on my life experience, that's great. But what about the things that I don't see that could propel me? What about the things that you just said? What do I want to be saying about myself in 25 years from now?
Well, we're not taught this. Actually, if you look at the curriculum in business schools and a lot of the other, you know, professional schools, I mean, it's really about, you know, when you look, for example, about, you know, business, it's really like, you know, to be successful in business, you have to have a great mind. That's the whole idea. And then, you know, there's also this sense that we all have, which is, to be successful in love, you have to have a great heart. But what a lot of people don't realize is that to be successful in business or any other career, you also have to have a great heart. And that sort of building the heart is really something that we're not taught. It sounds fluffy. It sounds like, oh, God, what is this guy talking about? You know, I'm getting uncomfortable here. But it's really, it's that heart connection that we make with others is what builds relationships and what brings us success.
No, absolutely, and it's not fluffy and it's not airy-fairy. It's truly what it is when you come right down to the bottom. You can call it a heart connection, a soul connection, spiritual connection, whatever you want to call it. It's that little something that inside there, I think you have two voices. That first voice is the one that says, no, you can't. And the other voice, if you really get quiet and listen, says, yes, you can. And it's that little voice underneath that needs to connect with that other person's little voice, the second one, then you both know you can, and then you are, and I love the title, then you are connected. There's your connection. Without that, I think we have major problems.
You know, Michael, we you know, an interesting thing is that a lot of people, when they think about really successful leaders, because, you know, I coach a lot of these folks, and a lot of people think, well, they don't have that other voice, the one that says, no, you can't. I can assure your listeners, each and every one of them do. I do. We all have that naysaying voice, that little chatterbox that says, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like the old Huckleberry Finn character, you know, it'll never work. You know, you're never going to be able to do this. You're not going to amount to anything. And I think what a lot of us do is that this is why we become workaholics and why we don't make that connection with our deeper selves, is that we attach our worth to our work. We say that I'm only worthy if I'm hitting and getting the results that I want. You know, if I'm not, then I'm worthless. I don't amount to anything, and that's what keeps us working until 8, 9 o'clock at night. It's what keeps us alienated from the people closest to us. Keeps us in these shells where especially in a down economy like we're in now. People say, oh, well, I just got to work harder and harder and harder, and they become more and more disconnected from themselves because, you know, you connect with yourself when you say, hey, you know what, it's 6, and I'm leaving the office. I'm going to go do something for me. I'm going to go take some time to reflect on what's most important. You may just go for a walk around the block for 20 minutes. You may go do yoga. You may go to a meditation. You may go to a football game. But you do something where you disconnect from detach from all the sort of influences around you. And then that's where you say, oh, you know what? Here's what I have to say to this client. I never thought of that. Or, you know, this is what's really going to drive this proposal forward. Those best ideas always come when we're out of the office.
You know, there's a prime example of what you're talking about, because it's that, and I'll say it in a different way, it's confusing who you are with what you do. And the greatest example of that is, did you see About Schmidt with Jack Nicholson?
I did, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, a great example, because his identity, he was the manager, whatever, and his identity was in that business. When the business was gone, he was lost. He got out there in the world, and he was nobody. He was nothing.
Well, it's kind of like, was it George Eastman, you know, founder of Kodak? I think when there was a certain point, it was like literally, I think if I remember this correctly, once he stopped working for Kodak, he committed suicide. He said, "You know what? My work is done. Why continue?" You know, a lot of us, you know, this whole thing about who you are versus what you do. In the connection, you talk about two voices. I also have two voices that I share in the connection. One is the visionary within each of us, and the other is what I call the actionary. So the visionary is the one that develops a vision for our lives and our careers, and then the actionary is the one that implements it, that makes it happen. And then when you think about the vision inside of you, that's who you really are. But then, you know, what you do is in terms of like the action steps, what you implement to reach that vision. These are two different things. And I think we are in such an action-oriented society, such a results-oriented society, that we kind of forget about like what's deeper than that. You know, I often tell people, you know, look, you know, don't just focus on the goal. Look beyond the goal to character. Because character is what's going to keep you achieving the goal more and more over the long term. And we see so many companies, especially when they get hard-pressed in a tough economy, where they forget about character and they just focus on getting as much profit as is humanly possible. And that's sort of their kiss of death for going under.
Sure. And by the way, two things. One, I want to go back to what you were talking about. There's another way to say this. We've learned for years and years and years that knowledge is power. That's not the power. It is the application of the knowledge which brings you to the power. You've got to get out and do it. And there's a rule, Tony, that I've lived by for many, many years now. And the rule is this, is that a good leader knows when to be a follower and a good teacher knows when to be a student. I change hats 3, 4, 5 times a week.
Well, absolutely. And it's interesting because so many people say, you know, the American dream, I want to become a leader, then I don't have to answer to anyone. I mean, I can assure you, you know, I run two leadership institutes, and I have so many bosses I couldn't count them on two hands. You know, I mean, it's kind of like the higher you rise, the more people you have to count to, and it's kind of like that old saying, you know, the higher a monkey climbs, the more the other monkeys look at its ass. You know, I mean, the further up you get, essentially the more people scrutinize everything you do. We see that with our politicians. We see that with our famous CEOs. And that's just how it is. And we have to get, I think they just have to build a comfort with that and have the humility to say, hey, you know, it's not about directing people around. It's really, you know, leadership is about service. It's about saying, what are the needs of others and how can I meet those needs? Really no different than in any other relationship.
Yeah, and I completely and totally agree. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this, Tony. By the way, this conversation could go on for a long time.
yeah, I agree.
What website that you're at, and how do we find you, the book, and everything you're doing?
Oh, thank you, Michael. Well, the website is leadglobal.org, so for the Global Leadership Institute. So it's leadglobal.org. And then my book is called The Connection. You can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever books are sold. If you just type in on Amazon, type in Anthony Szilard or type in The Connection and you'll find it.
Wonderful. Hey, Tony Szilard, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I've enjoyed it too.
Take care. Good night.
All right, you too. Good night.
You're gonna miss me, baby, some of these days. You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna be. Said some of these days I'd do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Carol Bettino with us. She is a professional counselor in a private practice in Prescott, Arizona. She's the author of, I've got it right here. I knew it. I know. Radio Susie said it. How about Directions, Your Roadmap to Happiness? We got it. Okay. And she's worked as a psychotherapist for over 20 years. She's authored two books, Better Choices, Better Life, and again, Directions, Your Roadmap to Happiness. She also hosted two radio shows at KFNX and 1100 AM, that's in Phoenix, and KQNA 1130 AM in Prescott. She's an active public speaker, conducted numerous workshops and various issues in the mental health field in Phoenix and Prescott. In those areas, Carol, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I blew the name of the book, but I promise I'll make it up to you.
That's okay.
Okay.
Quite okay. Now, the main thing is that you know that you need directions to get to happiness.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I really believe the word roadmap is there. Happiness does not just happen. There is a path to get there. There is a process to get there. And there's an awakening to get there.
I absolutely believe that, because so many times people say, I want to be happy, we want our kids to be happy, what's most important in our life is happiness, but so many times people don't know how to get there because they're stuck, and whether it's you're stuck in your past or stuck in a situation or you're just overwhelmed with life and the stresses in life, we just don't know how to move beyond that.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And when we really, you know, I've had... You're, let's see, the third interview tonight, and it's the same thing, not the subject matter, but it's the same thing, whether it's business, whether it's finance, whether it's whatever the case may be. The problem that we have is this. Nobody is there to show us how to get there. Nobody teaches us about what money means and what can happen to you when you get out of school. Nobody teaches you how to meet somebody and be in a great relationship. This list, Carol, goes on and on and on. So, yes, happiness is not just something that you trip on down the street and you find it.
Absolutely. That's why my book really does offer simple tools and exercises that really help you develop the skills that are necessary to just cope with everyday life, everyday stressors, and relationships, because that's where most people get into trouble, that their relationship is unhappy, the place that they're working they're not happy, that somehow they're not happy with the direction their life is going. And we sometimes forget we have a choice. We don't have to stay stuck, that there are choices, but we have to realize that some of our choices can lead us down a bad path.
Sure. And by the way, the other side of that, somebody said a long time ago, better unhappy than unsure. People are frightened to death to step into what whatever the unknown means to them. And sometimes when you take that step, you grit your teeth, you close your eyes, you take that step, it can be the best thing that ever happened to you.
Excellent point, because the unknown is why most people have anxiety. There are so many people who struggle with anxiety in life, and that's because they're always worried about the what if. What if this happens? What if that happens? Or they're worried about things that in the long run are meaningless into their lives. And I think what's really important is that when we realize that we have choice and we realize that we can make better choices in our life, that's when people start making changes and they don't worry about the unknown. They live in the here and now.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And I think one of the big ones, most people do not live in the present. They live in the past. I walk into the house, you look at me a certain way, and now somebody looked at me that 25 years ago, and I know what that means, and the argument is on, and we're fighting for the entire night, and you had nothing to do with it.
Well, you know, that old expression, I don't know how old it is, but you know how people are always saying, it's not about me, it's about, you know, it's not about you, it's about me. And a lot of times I think there's some seriousness in the sense of when you have some issues, you sometimes don't know how to deal with that with other people. In both my books, Directions, Your Roadmap to Happiness, and Better Choices, Better Life, I have chapters on relationships. And I talk about the importance of owning your own feelings and being accountable for your own actions.
Oh, wait, responsible? Wait, you mean be responsible? Oh, my goodness. Can we deal with
that? Yeah. You know, like when we were little kids, we had to be responsible. Yeah, except we shouldn't have to have somebody tell us to be responsible anymore.
True. You mean I have to be responsible for my emotions? I don't know if I can deal with it.
I know.
Prozac,
so. I know. Most people want to deal with their feelings by just taking a pill.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And somebody gave me a great example years and years and years ago. And it was most people drive down the quote unquote highway of life, steering with their hands on the rearview mirror. And they get into a lot of accidents because of it. And the only thing they have to do is just shift their thinking, drop their hands to the steering wheel and look forward. And the entire world changes. But you've got to be able to take that step. And sometimes you need somebody holding you by the hand to lead you through.
And that's absolutely true. And I think your point about looking in the back is so important. In my book, I use a quote that came out of the TV show, Touched by an Angel. And the man was abusive, and his childhood was very abusive. So he said to the angel, he said, how am I going to learn? I can't help it. I just keep looking at what it was. And she said, do you know why God put your eyes in the front of your head instead of your back? And he said, no. And she said, so that you can see where you're going instead of where you've been.
Yeah. And so many people are so involved, quote unquote, with themselves, and they don't look at the people around them. There was a movie years ago called Our Town. And the woman had died, and she was standing there with the angels, and they gave her a wish. And the wish was she could go back on her 12th birthday and celebrate it with her family. So she, you know, the angels wave the wand, quote unquote. She's standing in her bedroom. She's got, you know, her birthday dress on, and she's just looking great, and she's so proud of herself. And she gets halfway down the stairs, and she looks at her dad, and she's, Daddy, look at me. And her dad looked at her and said, don't bother me now. I'm busy. I'm making money so I can pay for this party. So she got downstairs, and her mom was there, and she says, Mama, look at me, look at my dress. And her mother says, don't bother me right now, I'm making the cake, I'm getting ready for the party. And she had tears in her eyes, and she looked up in heaven, and she said, this is too hard here, I want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's most people's lives.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the things I talk about in my book is principles to be happy and maintain happiness. And I think one of the things we have to do is to find a healthy connection between our mind, our body, and our spirit. We get hung up on the wrong things. We worry about the wrong things. And we stop, you know, what's important, and then we focus on, like, okay, the cake has to be done. The house has to look perfect, instead of just enjoying that party. And that connection between the mind, body, and spirit is such an important concept, because you have to be able to look beyond, you know, certain things and be able to find that inner happiness.
Oh, no question. I think that's the ability to look beyond. And most of us get into a place where the only thing that we can see is what's going on right now in front of us. And those choices, those options that we know that are out there, they're not familiar, they're not recognizable, and they don't look like there's something that you can hold on to. And so we let them drift away, and we get back into, you know, I got to live this life, and if this is my lot in life, I'm going to have to put up with it, and pain and misery. Well, okay, that's all right, I can deal with it.
Well, you know, that expression is that you have no control over the hand that's been dealt to you, but you have control over how you play that hand.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I focus on in therapy with my clients, as well as the focus in my book, is to be able to become more responsible and accountable for the direction we want our lives to go.
Okay, but how do you get the roadmap? Do you sit down? Do you write it out? What do you do with it? What gets you, Carol, how do you begin that path? Where do you put your foot?
I think when it comes to a roadmap, you have to ask yourself, what really is important to me in my life? If my family is important, then I shouldn't worry about if the cake that came out of the oven didn't make it. You know, I'll just make cupcakes. Yeah. If my family is important, I'm not going to worry that I didn't get my clothes dried in time and folded and put away before my guest came. We start to look at what makes you happy as a person. If what makes me happy as a person is my family, for me, it's always faith, family, and friends. That means for me that I need to make sure that I have a good connection with God. I need to know that I have a good connection with my family and a good connection with friends. What I love to do in my life is the job that I have, working with people, helping people overcome stress, anxiety, depression, anxiety, panic disorders, whatever it may be. If that's important to me, then I need to focus on making sure that that's the job I have, because then I love what I do and I'm not coming home stressed. So people have to look internally and ask themselves, what makes you happy? What's the things that are the most important to you? And that's how you should live your life.
There was a title of a book that had a tremendous impact on my life years and years and years ago, and I can't remember what her name is who wrote the book. I don't even know if she's doing anything anymore. But the title of the book was, What You Think About Me Is None of My Business. And I really had to think about that. Yes. And I got to a point where, and I really thought about it, and I just opened it up. I got to a point where I don't care what you think. That doesn't mean I don't respect you, but I'm not you. I'm not going to live my life based on your ideals and what you think is right for me. And I think so many people get caught in that trap. I could never, ever, never at my utmost, at my very best, be the first best you. I can only be a carbon copy and a secondhand I have a secondhand identity. So I can never be perfect. I can never be everything I can be if I'm trying to be you. The moment that I become me, those that like me will come to me. Those that I get along with will come to me. Those that don't like me will drift off. And you're going to have that. And I think one of the most important things, that lessons in life, is when somebody looks at you, they don't see you. They see themselves in you, what they like or they dislike. And you know the word, it's projection. And most people get caught. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, I've got a monthly blog where I put in positive affirmational quotes, because I feel that so many people have heard negative, whether it be at work, whether it be a past relationship, whatever it is, childhood, it doesn't matter. We hear the negative and we tend to focus on that. I like to to say that if the negative could have such an impact on your life, so can the positive. And I write these positive quotes in my blog every time, and one of them that I always focus on comes back to, I am not going to take what you do personally, because what you do is about you. It's not about me. I cannot control you, but I can control how I respond or react to you. And that goes back to kind of what you were just saying, that the importance is, I don't care what other people think. And that doesn't mean I'm snobby. That doesn't mean that I don't care. But if that's important to you, then you do it. So yeah. If what's important to you is that I get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and do some exercise, but I don't want to do it, I'm not going to be happy if I'm living my life trying to just please you.
Now, by the way, Radio Susie sitting over there on the opposite side of the desk doing all of her magic with her stuff on the computers. And
hi, Susie.
Said, hello.
Hello.
Bye, bye.
Hi,
bye,
Susie.
Go ahead.
Hi, Carol.
Can you hear
me? How are you?
I'm good.
Yes,
how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, and I'm hoping that you are letting your fingers just run over that keyboard, putting up my blog and my books and all of the good information so they can follow me.
Carol, it's up.
It's excellent. Awesome. Wonderful.
It's all there. But when I was mentioning her doing all of her magic over there, she looked at my face and she said, oh, God, here it comes. Okay, there's an example. And here she goes, here it comes again. Carol, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good looking, Michael?
Funny you should say that. But absolutely, and if you don't think so, somebody else will. That's the key.
Isn't that the truth?
Yes. I could have five women standing in front of me right now, and if I had the ability, I've used this example time and again, but if I had the ability to get behind each one, look at me through their eyes, Carol, I'd see five different Michaels. Some of them would be gorgeous, and some of the worst thing you ever saw in your life. I can't please everybody, but the ones who think I'm good looking are the ones that I'm going to be with.
And that's what makes people happy, is they stop trying to please everyone else. That does not mean that we don't go the extra mile to help somebody. It doesn't mean that we don't do things for other people. I've been in my marriage since I was 18 years old, and we have a great relationship. But I don't live my life based on the things that are most important to him. But that does mean that I include those things that are important to him because they become important to me. It's that old saying that I always loved, I don't love you because I need you. I need you because I love you. And we have to do the same thing for ourselves. And when we learn to love ourselves, it is amazing how happy we can be and how less depressed, less anxious, less angry, less bitter, that we can enjoy the simple things in life.
Let me give you the magic. We're starting to run out of time, but let me give you the magic of what keeps a relationship together in the very beginning. And this is what people do not do. How about you and I meet, okay? And we decide we like each other. And I say to you up front, how do you receive love? Now, by the way, if I've received love, let's say, to me, it's a wink, a look, a tone of voice expression. That's how I receive it. To you, let's say, hypothetically, it's I buy you something. So, but we don't go through that. We don't know. I think I know. You think you know. So we're together, and 2 years later, I walk into the house. You're packed up. You're leaving. I said, what's wrong? Well, I'm leaving. What do you mean you're leaving? You don't love me. What do you mean I don't love you? I didn't show you in the way you've learned to receive it. So if you go all the way back to the beginning and say, how do you receive love? And you get that out in front, that in and of itself would stop a lot of disasters in relationships.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I know we're running out of time, but I've got a couple of chapters on both of my books on relationship, and maybe we could at another time do an interview on relationships and just deal with the everyday stressors that affect couples in a relationship.
Absolutely. No problem. Now, your website where we can find you and get the books.
They can get the book anywhere, Amazon.com or any kind of a bookstore, and have it ordered. The blog is directionsaroadmaptohappiness.blogspot.com. But most people will, if they Google my name and Carol Bettino, B-E-T-T-I-N-O, they can get usually the blog, the Twitter, all of those kinds of things. The book itself is called Directions, Your Roadmap to Happiness, and the other book is Better Choices, Better Life.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being here.
It has been my pleasure. I appreciate your time. And like I said, looking forward to maybe working on that relationship information on our next interview.
Wonderful. Carol, good night.
All right. Have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
To enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Janet Pfeiffer with us. We're going to talk about something very special. January 20th, 2012, she will celebrate a very unique milestone no other, to her knowledge now, has ever achieved. She will have power walked every single day for the last 30 years. Regardless of the weather, she's walked in blizzards and rain and temperatures above 100 degrees and also below zero. Or her health. She'd had broken bones, torn cartilages, puncture wounds to her thighs, stitches, sprains, pinched nerves, and other assorted maladies. And she set out each morning on a trek at a pace of 4.7 miles an hour and even laced up her running shoes just hours after kidney surgery and completed daily excursions. And she did it and did it. And I think, where's that number I saw that was absolutely wonderful? It was something like what was, I think it was, where did I say it was 105,000 miles or very close to it? Let's see. Janet, what was the number? I missed that. How many miles have you walked?
Well, you were right, Michael. Over 105,000 miles in the past 30 years. And I'm
wow.
still going strong.
I guess. What stimulated all this?
Well, you know, I've always been a very athletic person, and I've always loved the outdoors. And when I started having children, you know, my life kind of became consumed with taking care of them and the home and everything else. And then January 19th, 1982, I was watching a movie on TV. It was called Running, and it starred Michael Douglas. And it was a story about a young man who was not happy with his life and realized that his passion was to run. And so he kind of dropped the conventional lifestyle and really just pursued his dream. And I thought, oh, my God, that's what I want to do. I want to run. So the next day, we had had a snowstorm. I put on my snow boots. I had my blue jeans on and my winter jacket. And I went out and ran a mile. And I was so exhilarated by that I just started, you know, adding more and more and more distance every week, and got up to the point where I was running 5 and 10K races and then half marathons. And then 3 years into my running, I switched to power walking because of an injury. And I just became so hooked on it that it has become a way of life for me.
Now, by the way, what this sounds like is you're probably one of the most stressless women in the world.
I am. Well, you know, people think that I'm crazy, you know, especially the fact that I'm out there every single day. And they say, well, you know, you don't really need to exercise that much. You're not fat. And I'm not. And I don't just do it to keep my weight down and to keep my muscles toned, but I also do it for the emotional benefits. I mean, when you're out there and you're engaging in aerobic type of activities, it releases endorphins and it actually calms you down and soothes you. So my time out there, you know, every morning, I get to work through any issues that are bothering me. If I'm angry with my husband, if I'm concerned about my company, you know, if I'm worried about my mom, I get to work through all of that and kind of put everything into perspective and really just allow myself to let go of that and still address the issues, but without all the stress and the anxiety. So I can deal with just about anything, and I very rarely get upset.
So it's not really exercise, it's therapy.
It's actually a form of both. You know, sure. I love the physical exertion. I love the fact that I'm burning calories and toning my muscles and keeping my cardiovascular system healthy. But it's also very much for me a form of therapy, especially being outdoors in nature. I just find that so cathartic. I find it just so relaxing. And just to be able to enjoy the beauty of nature during every season, it is just, you can't be stressed when you're out in nature. It's physically impossible.
Oh, no question about it. As a matter of fact, when you're doing it, have you found anybody to do it with? Has anybody got that impetus that you have to go on and do it the way you do?
Well, you know, Michael, I've actually had people ask if they could join me, and I'm really hesitant for several reasons. Number one is I really treasure my time alone. You know, I have a very demanding career. I have a big family, so I have a lot of responsibilities and obligations. I truly treasure that time just by myself. But those people who have made the attempt to join me, number one, they very rarely are willing to get up at the ridiculously early hour that I do, but they also can't keep up with my pace. And that's a big thing. I'll say to them, look, if you can walk at a speed of almost 5 miles an hour and you can keep up with me, come and join me. But
well,
I have yet to meet anybody.
What time do you start in the morning?
Well, I'm up. I used to get up at 3:30 in the morning. I did that for about 10 years. Now I've gotten a little lazy. I get up at 4:45.
Okay, Janet, I'm not going with you.
Shucks, and I was hoping I'd see you out there tomorrow morning.
It's over. I'm not going. Okay, no, but seriously, and why not? If it's something that you absolutely love, why not? Now, are there any drawbacks whatsoever?
Well, for me, you know, the biggest challenge really is the weather. I'm not fond of the heat, and so when I go out in the summertime, if the temperature is really high, and especially if the humidity is high, I really have to slow down a little bit, and I have to make sure that I take plenty of water with me. I usually carry a backpack with several water bottles. That's really the biggest disadvantage. I mean, I'm not fond of the snow and the rain, but you know what? I dress accordingly. And up where I live, we have black bears. So people, you know, are very concerned about them, and they ask me, you know, aren't you afraid of the bears? No, because they're not aggressive. I said I'm more concerned about drivers. You know, I put my life at risk when I'm out there and these drivers come flying by at 5 o'clock in the morning. The bears don't bother me. So for me, there really isn't much of a downside at all. It's definitely worth the time and energy that I put into it.
You know what? I would be this way. If I was one of the bears, and then there would be I'd be standing there with another bear, and the other bear would say, "It's a human. Let's go get her." And I would say, "Let's not. This might be contagious."
I love that. I don't think they could keep up with me anyhow.
I know when it really comes down to it. Let me ask you this. Obviously, you've been doing it for 30 years, and you were probably 1 or 2 years old when you started. I got that loud and clear. But when
oh, you're so sweet.
when do you think you'll stop? What time?
I don't intend to ever stop. I actually will be 63 years old next month. I maintain my ideal body weight for the past 45 years. I'm in as good a shape as I've ever been in my life. This is something that I honestly cannot ever see myself giving up. So I'd say for at least the next 35 to 40 years.
Okay. No, why not? Radio Susie's sitting over there, and she said, "Well, that's close to where I'm at, close to where I'm at." See, it was good. She said, "I'm not doing that, though."
Well, you know what? I have to say, Michael, it's not for everybody. I mean, I think I'm a little extreme in that, but it works for me. It's what I absolutely love doing. But, you know, the key for people is you have to find what you're really passionate about. You have to really pursue some type of physical activity that you enjoy doing. Otherwise, you're not going to stay with it.
Oh, Janet, I play with it, but I think it's absolutely wonderful because, you know, I'm older than you are, and I still work out, and I still do all of those things, and it's what I like to do. It is a way of life for me. I would drive most people nuts with what I do physically. But the point of contention is I enjoy it, and if you enjoy it, it's the most important thing in the world. You know, I play with you with this, but I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, and you're right. You know, you have to do what you love, and as long as it's not interfering with the rest of your life, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. That's why I do it first thing in the morning, because it's the only time during the day that nobody wants me. It's like once my husband gets up, once the world starts, you know, it's everybody's calling you on the phone, and people, you know, need to talk to you or have you do things. It's the only time of day that truly belongs just to me.
Yeah. No, I got you, and I do truly understand that. What am I going to get out of this? I listen to everything that you have to say. I love everything you have to say. But the average person, what's the takeaway? What's the core message here to people?
Well, I think the core message is, like for me, you know, being in my 60s, people think that as you get older, it means slowing down, you know, developing medical problems, putting limitations on what you're able to do. I don't believe in that. I believe that every day I will age, but I will never get old, because I truly believe that you can keep yourself young and physically fit and mentally alert, and incorporating some type of good aerobic exercise into your regimen every day, or even, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. It doesn't have to be every day like me. But as long as you keep yourself physically active and mentally challenged, you don't have to age. You don't have to suffer with a lot of the issues that the elderly face. You know, people look at me and they cannot believe that I'm 63 years old, because I can keep up with people half my age. And it's only because I make that choice to keep myself physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually young.
No question about it. And I really believe when exercise, to whatever degree, you know, especially with women, when you hit 55, 60 years old, you know, you're talking osteoporosis, you're talking bone problems. Mm-hmm. Any medical doctor will tell you, weight training, it works. Exercise, it works. Exercise gets your blood flowing. Exercise keeps your brain moving. I mean, all of those things happen if you just take the time to do it.
Yeah, and exercise isn't a dirty word. I mean, no. It's actually something that's fun and exciting. Again, you just have to find what works for you. There's so many different forms of exercise. Find the one that works for you. Pick a time of day that is most conducive to your schedule, and then stick with it. And that's really the key.
Yeah, and by the way, obviously, you're doing the extreme for most people, and you don't have to get up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and you don't have to run that many miles a day. But I guess the real message here is do something. You know, and yep. Have you ever thanked Michael Douglas? Have you ever met him and said thank you?
No, and I would actually like to. he has no idea at all how he's changed my life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Some of the people that are in the position that Douglas is in and so many people like that, they have no idea. There might be a certain something that they do that changes somebody's life completely without even thinking about it.
And you know what, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I'm actually a very big believer in thanking people for the way that they have impacted my life, and I will do it years and years, you know, down the road if I remember something. I need to find out how to contact him. I need to thank him.
You know what I would do? I would Google Michael Douglas and his Michael Douglas's agent, and
yes.
You'll find it.
Yep.
Yeah, because I think
it's
great.
That.
Yeah, because I'm quite confident that he would love to hear your input. You know,
and
you
I
know
would
what?
Love
I just
to give
I read
it to
something
him.
About him. The other day. I read something about him the other day. You know, he's going to do a new movie. You still there?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you'll never guess the character he's going to play. Are you sitting down for this? You better be.
I'm sitting down.
How about Liberace?
Oh my God! I used to be such a huge Liberace fan when I was a kid.
Yeah, no, Douglas is that. That's the
fabulous.
Next one coming up, which has got to be good. Okay, we're starting to run out of time,
amazing.
So I want to make sure we get your website and go from there. So, how do we find you? Besides 3 o'clock in the morning, running around.
Yeah, you can come by and just I'll be outside. My website is PfeifferPowerSeminars.com, and Pfeiffer is spelled with a P-F-E-I-F-F-E-R, and all of my contact information is on my website.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so we go to, say it one more time.
PfeifferPowerSeminars.com, or you can
wonderful.
Just Google my name, Janet Pfeiffer, and I'll come up.
Janet, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated it. I think it's great. Find Douglas and tell him thank you.
I certainly will. And Michael, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to speak with you this evening.
My pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy, 'cause I wanna be. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long. For you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange. Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. Music that used to seem hollow now seems to fit in your range. Today is the now and the never. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change.
It's Peter Early with us, the author of The Serial Killer Whisperer, How One Man's Tragedy Helped Unlock the Deadliest Secrets of the World's Most Terrifying Killers. He's an author. He's a New York Times bestseller. He's won an Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2007. Pete Early, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael, for having me. That's quite a title, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. My goodness, what was it that got you involved in that in the first place? What was that that triggered you to even put this to pen?
Well, I've always been interested in the brain, and this was a story. It started out as a 15-year-old kid, ordinary teenager, who gets smacked in the head by a jet ski during a horrible accident at a summer camp. And he literally, his heart stops three times on the way to the emergency room. They bring him back, luckily, and he goes into a coma. And when he emerges, he has a severe traumatic brain injury. The inside of his brain was shaken so badly. He had to relearn how to talk, how to walk. He had to learn all these things, just like Gabby Gifford. The difference was that he came out a completely different person. He had uncontrollable rages. He was suicidal. And he had a disconnect that made him hard to even relate to his own parents. He had OCD. And he also, and they didn't know if this was his age or part of the brain damage, he had hypersexuality, and he was very self-involved. And the parents were just, you know, they loved their son, but they couldn't take him out. He would say inappropriate things. He would attack people. So for basically 5 years, he was housebound. And then as psychiatrists, they're working with medication. He starts to get better, but they say, you know, you can't just live in a house your whole life. You need a hobby. And so on a lark, watching TV one night, he got interested in the serial killer, and he started writing to him. And he felt like he was in his own prison, Michael, in his own house. And he identified with him. And if you look at the characteristics of a serial killer, you'll see that they mimicked this young man, Tony Siaglia's, traumatic brain injury. And he develops friendships over the next 5 years with, he writes to more than 33, and he becomes very close to a lot of these serial killers, just horrible people. But he doesn't mind corresponding with them. He's not, has no empathy. He doesn't get upset when they talk about such gruesome things as cannibalism and torture and murder. In fact, he feels a bond with them, and they love it because they have somebody writing to them who's enamored with them, and they have this relationship. And eventually he kind of gets sucked into their world, and his parents become alarmed, his doctors become alarmed, and they do an intervention and try to get him to do something else. And then they discover that he can use his talent to actually try to help solve some of the crimes these serial killers committed. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children contact him. And so it's the story of his journey through this really dark area in our society.
Now, let me ask you this. In the press release, there's about 20 serial killers, with just a quick breakdown of each one. Was there an overarching theme? Was there commonality that ran through each and every one of them? What did you find?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I spent a lot of time talking to the experts, and obviously, you know, I was interested in how this kid fit into this story, this young man. And, you know, they can tell you certain specific things, Michael. They can say a serial killer has no empathy. They have no remorse. They have no regrets. They don't look at people as anything but, you know, like rabbits to be used or puppets on a stage. And these serial killers are all highly narcissistic. We know what the symptoms are. What we don't know is what causes this. And there's kind of three theories. You know, people say, well, there's a genetic predisposition. For some reason, someone is born perhaps without empathy, or they have damage in their front lobe somehow. We don't. And others will say, no, it's all environmental. They were abused as children. And then others will say, no, there's actually some kind of brain defect in there. So, you know, the problem is we don't know what causes them. We know the symptoms. And I tell you what makes this book unusual and why I decided to do it. And I got to warn your listeners, this is gruesome stuff. We had a real, my editor and I spent a lot of sleepless nights because the thing that's unique about this book, Michael, is most of these serial killers preen before cameras. They love being interviewed by psychiatrists, and they love getting interviews to reporters. They love the spotlight on them. What was unique about this kid is he wrote to him for 5 years, and it was more like two people just stopping after a bar after work. And these guys really, really opened up to him in a way that I've never seen. And it exposes their warped personalities. And that is what you got to justify as a reporter why putting some of this stuff up is worth reading. And the reason it is because you'll never see get a clearer look at how these people really think. And it's terrifying.
Pete, I'm looking at two things. I'm listening to what you're saying very closely, and I was kind of glancing through, you know, those 1920 serial killers.
Right.
Two words come up for me. One is identity, and the other one is definition. You know, we run our lives based on definition. What you think something means and what I think something means can be two completely different things. And if we would define killing, I don't know if we can do that or not, but I wonder what would happen if we would have asked each one of these killers, what does killing mean? How do you define it? And it would be interesting to get a definition. The other side of that is when you were talking about their narcissistic approach to life, identity. In and of itself, this is the only way that they can say, this is who I am. This is what they would hang on to.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful, Michael. What you'll see with somebody like Arthur Shawcross, who murdered 11 prostitutes in the Rochester area, was that he was a loser. Nobody paid any attention to him. He had grandiosity. He thought he was special. He had severe sexual dysfunctions. And so what he describes in this letter was that killing gave him the ultimate power. In fact, he describes how he would choke people and then bring them back just so he could choke them again. And what you begin to see is that there are all these people, all these serial killers, I shouldn't say all, but most target women, and most of them rape and torture them. And the thing about it is, though, it's the power in his case, the ultimate power that he could be God. Here was this guy who, if you walked down the street, nobody would pay any attention to him, but he can control everything about this person. And what you saw with Shawcross and the two of the other ones who were really highlighted in it is that they were in no rush, that they spent hours with these people because it was this constant power trip for them. And as you said, it kind of defined for a moment there, they were somebody important.
You know, and it's interesting. Now, whether or not it would be some kind of a brain function, a problem with a chemical that does or doesn't get there to cause them to be the way that they are, there's got to be something. I wonder if there would have been, and we'll never know this, if there would have been something in their lives prior to this happening that could have stopped all of this, could have put them in a direction that they could have led whatever a decent life is. And I'm really wondering if they would have the propensity for it, yes, but I wonder if it could have been altered in some way when they were younger.
I think absolutely. And I think the main character in my book, Tony Siaglia, shows that. This kid has a brain, traumatic brain injury. I can't stress this enough. The psychiatrist, maybe there's 10 things that identify a serial killer, and they're saying, boom, 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 this kid mimics them. But he didn't become a serial killer. And why didn't he become a serial killer? Well, one answer is he has a really strong, supportive family who has spent their whole lives since that accident watching him, taking care of him, monitoring his actions, helping him. We also know now that the brain is elastic, which means that it does repair itself. And you also have to fit in another commonality they'll tell you about serial killers is that they were, a lot of them were molested as children and sexually abused. He didn't have any of that. So, yes, it makes you wonder if it doesn't take more than just perhaps a damaged or flawed brain to spark this. And, you know, the FBI estimates that at any given moment in America, there are at least 50 of serial killers walking around killing people. So it's a very small, small number, but the damage they cause is, you know, unbelievable.
I think with Siaglia, what we're talking about is he didn't have to prove himself. And when you really come down to it, everything you're saying, what we're hearing underneath it, is they had to prove themselves. Somewhere in their life, they were lacking somewhere, obviously. I mean, that doesn't take a genius to figure that out. But the point of contention is there was that something else that if they were going to leave a legacy, that's probably what it was. The killing is the legacy.
Well, I think you may have a very strong point there. I've spent a lot of my career, 30-some years as a journalist, looking at criminals, and I spent a year inside a U.S. penitentiary off and on as a reporter. I'd go out 23 days and come back. And the thing that struck me oftentimes is what you're talking about, a lack of identity and a narcissistic personality, where when it comes to push to shove, you know, all you really care about is yourself and instant gratification. The difference with another serial killer in this book, David Gore, was the whole sexual side of it, which this guy had almost a compulsion. He had to, he felt like he had to rape people, rape women. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of a stew pot there, and I think each one is individual, but I do think that what you're talking about obviously is a main part of the personality.
Absolutely. You know, and I would venture to guess, Pete, and there's no way to prove this, that every one of those women were mama. And there's no way that we can go back and say that this is so and hit it. But when you really come down to it, what you don't get out of your mom and dad is what you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to find through other people. And if you got to take it out on somebody, watch out if you're in a relationship, or watch out if you become, quote unquote, one of these guys. One of the things that I saw, I spent a day in prison. It was, what was it, about 15, 18 years ago. It was in Fairbanks, Alaska. And there was, at the radio station, in the floor below it, there was a cab company. And the owner of the cab company had been killed, and two of the cab drivers were caught at the airport. And, you know, they were bloody, they had the money, and so on and so forth. They arrested them. So I'm sitting at my desk, and I get a phone call, and it's from the guy who killed the owner. Now, I knew who he was. He used to come up to the radio station to get advertising all the time. And I said, I wanted to talk to you. And I said, aren't you in jail? And he said, yeah, but we get to have one phone call. And he said, you had a psychic on a week or two ago, and this isn't right. Something is wrong here, and yada, yada. So I hung up the phone, and I called the chief of police. Yeah, and I said to him, why can he call me? He just got arrested. And one thing led to the other, and I said, I want to find out what goes on in the prison. So the chief of police called the warden, and we set something up, and they came over to the studio the next day, and they arrested me. And, you know, they put me in the cuffs. I get to go through the whole thing. Took me in. Now, I got to tell you, when they closed those doors, I knew I was getting out the next day, but, Pete, that was scary. So I got in. They dressed me down. I mean, I was dressed just like everybody else. And when I went to chow, I'm telling you, you couldn't tell the difference between me and another prisoner. Now, at night, I went into the day room, but I told the guard up front, I said, tell them who I am, because I don't want to invade anybody. And they did, and I sat down at the table, and they started coming up one by one, you know, and we started talking. And they got comfortable, and we were just doing whatever. One of the problems that they have there, and I think this ties with the serial killer too, the recidivism rate is tremendous. And one of the reasons for that is they can't make it on the outside. If you think about it, when they go to jail, they get fed, they get clothed, they get taken care of, quote unquote, like it or not. And they end up with their quote unquote identity again. And a lot of these guys were, you know, a lot of them found God until they got out and so on and so forth. But for the most part, they didn't do it. And then when they got out, they came back. And I really believe it comes down to, you can't make it out there, so let me go back to a place that's comfortable. There, again, that word identity is so critically important. And I think with the serial killers, and I'm not an expert, I haven't done any research, but it's just obvious that they're doing what they think will cause them to be recognized, and at least they've made their mark when they die.
Well, that certainly, and speaking of Alaska, one of the main characters in the book who Tony Siaglia actually helps the police with is Robert Hansen, who was a notorious serial killer in Alaska, hunted women. So, you know, they hit every state.
Yeah. No, I was up there from 83 until 2006. So that was around there for a while. But I think that's really what is, and I really believe if you look into this, you, not as Pete, but you in the general sense of the word, you could probably see yourself here, but exaggerated 5 million times.
See yourself in what way? As a psychopath?
With the serial killers, what they're doing. But symbolically, not necessarily raping and killing women, but symbolically, I would bet any amount of money that most people, when they got into it, they'd see themselves within the story. They'd recognize a familiar something of the direction that these guys take.
I these guys are so far off the norm. I think that they are just so far over. It's hard to imagine, but I do think that people are fascinated with them, and that they can see some common characteristics that certainly.
That's what I'm talking about. Because the only reason anybody will get involved in something is if it's familiar to them. They recognize. Mm-hmm. Something about themselves inside. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go out and kill or they've ever done anything like that. But
no, I think you're right in the sense that I think all of us are fascinated or we get curious about somebody who can kill somebody and have no feelings, empathy, or concern about it. I mean, I think that's such a strange sensation for most of us that we're just fascinated by how can somebody be that way?
Yeah, here, let me ask you this, and I think it's going to be an interesting answer. In all authors, when you put something to pen, it doesn't matter, Pete, whether it's fact, fun, fantasy, whatever. There comes that time in the writing and the research where there is that aha moment, that epiphany, that cathartic moment when you realize something about the subject matter that you weren't even aware of. Where was that for you?
I think it was, with me, it was trying to understand the traumatic brain injury and how this kid was caught in his own type of prison and how desperate people are to have some connection with somebody else. I mean, one of the things that kind of mystified me was that the serial killer has no empathy, has no caring about other people, has a hard time connecting with them, but wanted the adulation, still needed that human connection,
sure.
If you're following me. Some kind of feeling. And when I was in the prison talking to people, you know, even the worst guy I knew in there wanted to look in the mirror and see what he saw. So you got a lot of rationalization, you got a lot of justification, and that certainly comes through in the letters that these guys write. There is no empathy for the victims. Most of the victims deserved it. One serial killer talks about how they were a bunch of drug addicts and whores, and they were only a step away from grave. So you see people constantly trying to justify. The thing that's interesting about the serial killers is that they love to talk about themselves, and they love to try to figure out why they are the way they are, and it's questionable whether they really have any insight. It's just that they love being, as you said, somebody.
Yeah. Now, Pete, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at, get the books, and find out what you're doing. Have you got a blog post?
Yeah, you can contact me on www.PeteEarley.com. The books are available at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, but I'd love to have people visit my website and read more about it.
Wonderful. Hey, Pete Early, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. You have a great evening.
You too. Good night.
Right.
Whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Once upon a time.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ken Solon with us. He is the author of Act Like a Man. Really, there's hope. Men can change. He's an author. He's a speaker. He grew up to manhood with little idea of what acting like a man was all about. Coming from an abusive home, he got his lessons in the street and struggled with anger, abandonment, and all the issues well into his 40s. He raised two sons, a single father, and was friendless and alone. Now, 20 years ago, Ken put together a men's group where eight guys met, and they continue to meet to teach each other the lessons of manhood that most people don't get from their fathers and to work through the issues that affect their relationships and limit their lives. Hey, Ken, welcome back. It's been a while. How are you?
It sure has, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, I really wonder, if you and I walked out on the street, any given city and country, anywhere, at any time, and we would ask men that we met, what's a man? I would bet we'd get a lot of people who couldn't answer it and would come up with probably more definitions than you and I could write down on paper.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
How do you deal with that when we say there's hope, men can change? What can we change to? What is that that causes us, that can cause us, to be whatever a man is?
Well, you know, it's incredible, Michael. I think that a guy who injures himself working out in a gym, he'll look for a physical therapist immediately before he even gets home. But the same guy will suck up his pain and suffer in silence when his emotional issues overwhelm him, even when that means inflicting his issues on the woman and he's in relationship with, or even men he's friends with. And it's just, why do men choose to suffer? You know, it's about fear and lack of trust. You know, unfortunately for most guys, they go together like peanut butter and jelly.
Sure. Now, you know, by the way, I remember this was interesting about what being a man is. I'm 16 years old. I'm sitting in the car with somebody. She's breaking up with me, right? I'm destroyed here. She met an older man. He was 18 going to college, right? And she said to me, I'll never forget. She said, "You'll never be the man he is." And in my mind, I thought, well, I could kick his butt, You know, that was, and at 16 years old, that's a man. But as I grew, I began to realize that that's not a man. And as I grew, what I began to realize is a man is somebody who takes responsibility for his actions, his emotions, and his world.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. I started writing for Huffington Post several months ago, and I mostly write about men in relationships, and sometimes I get as many as 900 comments on my articles. A lot of them are from women, but most of them are from angry guys who just, they're so insecure that they just insist that the new woman is a myth and they don't want to have anything to do with it, and it's not their responsibility to do the emotional work. That's women's stuff. And it's only wimpy guys who get together and talk about their issues. And to me, I think, you know, the ultimate wimpy guy is a guy who's too afraid to deal with his issues and keeps inflicting them on people. But there's a lot of guys out there who are real insecure about the new woman, the woman who's working, bringing home at least half the money, sometimes more, who isn't necessarily staying home to raise kids anymore. A lot of men are intimidated by that because they don't feel secure in their own manhood.
Yeah, one of the things, though, Ken, that I've noticed, that men have been being beaten down. And when I say beaten down, this feminism thing that, and I say thing that happened, let me do it this way before I go any farther with it. Let me define feminism from my perspective. If feminism is the subjugation of man to get ahead, I'm on the other side of the table and you're going to get nothing, not you, but just anybody, you're going to get a battle out of me. But if feminism is equality of opportunity, I'm on board across the board. And I think what's happened is it's taken on a little bit of a different look, and it's suppressed a lot of the men. I walk into a market today, and I see a lot of tough women, and the guys that are with them are a little bit sensitive. That's not all of us, but you hear what I'm saying. It's a different kind of guy out there, the way they're being brought up. They can't say anything. They open their mouth, and they're going to get sued or thrown in jail.
Well, I think the myth, though, is that the ascent of women has to mean the descent of men, and that just isn't true. You know, it's a competitive world. Women are taking up half the spots in law school, medical school, graduate schools of all kinds, and they're going to be out in the marketplace competing. But it's a competitive world, and men are having to compete with men from around the world as well as women. So it isn't that women are doing better, so men have to do worse. Men are just going to have to work a little harder. They can't expect women to go back into the kitchen and remain barefoot and pregnant. That just isn't going to happen. So
they can either complain
and be miserable, or they can be a part of the new paradigm, which is men and women absolutely treating each other as equals in every way.
Yeah. So, well, let me hold up just one part of that statement, okay? Emotionally, intellectually, absolutely. Physically, no. I don't think I would.
No,
I don't.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not. You won't see a woman as a guard on a football team. So you know, and they would get hurt.
I don't think so. But then again, you won't see that many guys playing football either
these days,
especially guys when they get a little older. I think, you know, the book chronicles eight guys over 20 years, and it tells their stories, their absolute unvarnished stories in their own words. And I think, I know one of the Amazon reviewers who reviewed my book, and all the reviews, by the way, have been 5-star, which I've been thrilled with. One woman wrote that reading Act Like a Man was like watching reality television. She said it was just such a read she couldn't put it down. This is the chance, the only chance probably a woman's ever going to have to hear exactly what it is that men talk about when women aren't around.
Now, by the way, see, that's perfect. That's the been there, done that kind of thing. The book comes from walking the walk and not just academic assumptions of how things are. You get eight guys from different walks of life that have met for a number of years and they discuss what's going on. You're going to get different opinions, and you're going to get opinions that will bring you centrally to a mindset.
Exactly. I mean, what could be more valuable for a guy who's just in the throes of divorce? I mean, he can go to individual therapy and he can pay a guy to tell him, you know, you need to get in touch with your feelings. Or he can sit with eight other guys, half of whom have been divorced, and he can ask them, what was it like for you? And they can tell him what it was like on an emotional level, what they did that worked, what they did that didn't work. I mean, they can really give this guy real-life help as opposed to advice, which a friend of mine describes as the lowest form of conversation. You know, this is real life experiential information. That's invaluable, and it's worth all the therapy in the world because it's honest and it's authentic. You know, a guy who can't feel his own pain, he's not going to feel anyone else's pain either. So what woman would consciously want to be in a relationship with an emotionally brain-dead guy? Well, not many, and probably that's why women are always asking me where are all the good guys. And, you know, I tell them they're sitting with other guys trying to become better guys.
Well, wait, wait, Radio Susie's over there with a computer going, yeah, right, yeah, I agree with him.
Well, you know, it's sort of, it's almost indisputable. I mean, there was nothing special about the guys in my group. We're just regular guys. You know, we work, we raise kids, we had divorces, we had relationships. There was, you know, we were all different races and religions. The common theme was we were all men and we were all struggling to understand, you know, what that means. And, you know, now we know, 20 years later, although it didn't take that long. It only took a couple of years to get a pretty good idea. But we learn how to handle our emotional problems without losing it. To be, I think for men to become empowered means to be aware and in control of your emotions. That's real power. If you can be aware, because a lot of guys get angry, but they don't know why, they don't know what it is, and they don't know how to react to it. They just lose it. If you can control your behavior by understanding it as it happens, that's what being a man, I think, what being a man is. It's a guy who's in control of his life.
Yeah, but Ken, you have to learn that. That's the key.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I mean, we all had to learn it. None of the guys in my group were guys who knew how to do this. We all taught. We learned it together. We taught it to each other. We listened to each other. And we told each other the truth when we felt like, you know, the other guy wasn't getting it. We told him the truth. But, yes, yeah. It is absolutely for men. It's learned behavior.
Well, by the way, I think with women it's learned also, because we don't know how. Who is it that teaches you how to be in a relationship? Nobody. You go out and,
right.
you go with somebody. You make your mistakes. It's good. It's bad. It's indifferent. You want, and you do it again. And you can, and unless there's somebody that says, take a look at what you're doing or what you're not doing, you keep repeating the same old mistakes and end up home alone crying.
Exactly. You know, and unfortunately for most guys, our dads didn't teach us much of anything that was useful in terms of how to behave like a man. You know, my father was one of those guys who sucked it up and never said much, except when he was really angry, he took it out on me.
Yeah.
That was my lesson, that it was okay for a man to be angry, to lose his temper a lot, to yell, and sometimes to be violent. That was my lesson. So, you know, the other guys' lessons in the group were anything from benign neglect to violence, and most guys fell someplace in the middle. But in all the years I've been talking with men about this issue, I've only met a handful of guys who had great dads. And I love hearing their stories, because I really appreciate what that must have felt like.
But Ken, when you get into it, you know, when you think about it, your father, my father, learned from their father who learned from their father. And if they didn't
exactly.
know, they have nothing to teach you.
Exactly. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, boys went out with their fathers into the fields or into their trade, whatever it was. They spent the day with them, and fathers taught them how to be men. And as soon as men went to work in the factories, they left their sons at home to be raised by their mothers. Well, women did a great job, but the truth is, how can a woman raise a boy to be a man if she's a woman? That's a man's job, to put his imprint on that boy, his manhood imprint. And the problem with so many boys today is they don't have fathers. They're from divorced homes where fathers are either not involved enough or they don't see them often enough. And they're out in the streets trying to figure out how to be men, and that's really sad.
Ken, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you, find a book, and follow along with what you're doing.
Okay, it's www.kensolin.com, kensolin.com. And the book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available in print or Kindle. I promise every guy, you know, you're in this book. Your issues are in this book, and it'll help you not only resolve your issues, but it'll help you start your own group. And for women, it's the guy you want your husband and boyfriend to be. And here's how. And you should put it on his nightstand and beg him to read it, because it'll change his life.
Hey, Ken Solon, thank you so much for your time. And by the way, don't be a stranger.
Hey, Michael, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.